Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Vladimir Yurovsky. He conducts the Philadelphia Orchestra in the final concert of a week-long engagement at the Kimmel Center tonight. Susan Lewis looks at a new one-woman show at the Philadelphia Theatre Company about the late political columnist Molly Ivins. Red Hot Patriot, the kick-ass wit of Molly Ivins, stars Kathleen Turner. And though music groups continue to try to attract younger patrons, seniors are still the backbone of the classical music community. David Patrick Stearns looks at the importance of this loyal, knowledgeable audience. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
This week, the Russian conductor Vladimir Yurovsky returned for the fourth time to conduct the Philadelphia Orchestra. He made his American orchestral debut with the ensemble in 2005. Yurovsky's career has been in the ascendancy since 1999, when he made his U.S. opera debut at the Metropolitan Opera at age 26. In 2001, he became music director of the Glyndebourne Festival Opera. He became a principal artist of the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment in 2006, and a year later became principal conductor of the London Philharmonic Orchestra. At one time, Yurovsky was the leading candidate to become the next music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra, and although there's been no official word, it would appear that he no longer wants to be considered for the job. This week, Yurovsky returned to Philadelphia with, for the first time, an all-classical program: Brahms' Tragic Overture, Schumann's Piano Concerto with Benedetto Lupo as soloist, and Beethoven's mighty Eroica Symphony. I spoke with Vladimir Yurovsky on his last visit to Philadelphia and first asked him about the connections between the different pieces in this week's program.
Beethoven is, so to speak, a father or grandfather of both of them, of Schumann and Brahms, especially of Brahms. This is actually the first time that I'm doing an exclusively classical program with the Philadelphia Orchestra, because every time I came before, it was either with something from the 20th century or lesser-known repertory. Since our relationship with the orchestra developed in such a way that I am one of their permanent guest conductors nowadays, I find it very important to extend our repertory and get onto the field of classical music, which is always the most difficult, and it is also probably the best proof of a good relationship between a conductor and an orchestra if they get along in classical pieces. Because it's much easier to get along in pieces the orchestra doesn't know. But with Eroica or Schumann Piano Concerto, which they've done millions of times, I'll need to prove my case. And probably some of them will find the readings of these very familiar works somewhat unexpected or unorthodox, but we'll see. I have a good premonition about this.
When you were here in October, was it my imagination or was your conducting style becoming more relaxed in relation to the orchestra? There were times when I felt that you were almost leading them with your eyes. There were great, intense physical moments, but also there were times when they knew what you wanted, I felt.
Well, it's a natural development of a relationship, which means increasing trust between both participants. It's like in a human relationship, the closer you come together with your partner, the more you can trust each other and the less you need to say to be understood. And I feel now we are entering in a kind of a new chapter of our relationship, which started in the fall 2005. So it's been over 4 years now. And the fact that I'm relaxed is because I know they know what I want, and because I'm also absolutely sure they will follow me wherever I'll take them.
Specifically in this program, there are a couple of interesting items. The Brahms has some interesting rhythmic structures. Are they a challenge to a conductor? Is there a specific approach you need with something of this complexity?
Well, I think Brahms's rhythmic structures are not nearly as intricate and as complex as those by Schumann. And this is actually where he learned his craft, from Schumann. Therefore, the first connection. And if you go further back in history, the most intricate rhythmic, metrorhythmic structures ever you find in the Eroica. Of all Beethoven symphonies, this is rhythmically the most challenging. So the whole program is becoming a kind of a study in rhythmic complexities. But I think the main issue with both Brahms and Schumann, and eventually also with Beethoven, is the necessity of overcoming the herd of the bar lines. In order to pay the necessary tribute to all of the details of the compositional work, you need to be able, and not just you as a conductor on your own, you, I mean every performing musician, the entire orchestra needs to be capable of obliterating the bar lines and being able to look over them, beyond them.
To the overall arc of the piece.
To the overall, not only overall arc of the piece, but the structures which are often laid as patterns over the bar lines, over several bar lines. And that's the challenge. And again, this is only achievable in a very good orchestra, but also when the relationship between the orchestra and conductor is such that the conductor is not expected to beat every downbeat with the same clarity. Because by beating every downbeat with the same clarity, we underline, we stress, we emphasize the exactly those
the
herds
bass in the bar, yeah.
which are impeding the natural phrasing.
The Eroica, when it came out, was not only rhythmically complex, it was also very long. It's now become a part of the standard repertoire. How do you approach something that is so familiar both to the musicians and to the audience?
Well, I'm always hoping to bring back to the piece the sensation which the audiences and the musicians of the time must have experienced when playing this piece for the first time through. And in case of a Beethoven, it was certainly a shock. By the way, about the length of the symphony, it is still one of the longest symphonies, maybe with the exception of the Mahler and Bruckner. But among the normal four-cycled symphonies, it is one of the longest, especially if you repeat the exposition of the first movement, which I do.
When we spoke before, you talked about how you approached repertoire generally, and you talked about you being ready for a lot of works in time, that you were going to take your time in getting the things. It was a question of your own artistic maturity, your own personal maturity. That's true in the realm of symphonic music. Is that also true for you in the realm of opera? Because you take on some phenomenally challenging operas.
Yeah, but I take them after serious consideration, and I always take them after very long period of preparation, and there are still some operas which I haven't done for this very reason, like I haven't done The Ring.
But you've done Falstaff.
I've done Falstaff, but before having done Falstaff, I've done at least another five operas by Verdi, including Otello, including Macbeth,
right.
Don Carlo, including Rigoletto, including Nabucco. So I've done my Verdi before coming to Falstaff.
So then what's the trajectory for Wagner?
The trajectory from Wagner was a backward one, but I'm not alone there. I sort of followed the example of Pierre Boulez, who started with Parsifal and then did Tristan and then came to The Ring. That's exactly what I'm doing, except there will be one station on the way to The Ring, which Boulez consciously bypassed and I won't bypass. It's the Meistersinger. So I have done my Parsifal, I now did my Tristan, I will do Meistersinger in 11. And it's only, I won't take on any offers for Ring until I've turned 40, which will be in 12.
So then, going back to the Beethoven, how long have you been performing the Eroica, and where does that fit in the arc of your own symphonic conducting evolution, do you think?
Well, it took me a long time to come to Eroica, and there was not like with the Mahler symphonies where I gave myself a solemn oath to perform them in order, starting with Das Klagende Lied. In Beethoven, I started when I was very young with 4 and 6, and then I did 7. I did 1 and 2 in my college years, but never publicly, just with student orchestras. And then I came to 3. But I've been doing Eroica for the past 5 years, and it was only recently that I started doing it with modern orchestras, because my first Eroica I did on period instruments.
Why that choice?
Well, because I wanted to learn from the players. I wanted to learn about the style, and I also wanted to hear this music as close to the original experience as possible. Now I can bring my experience with these instruments to a modern orchestra and make them sound partly like a period group.
And final question, when you were in that period of doing, say, Beethoven on original instruments, did you get to the point where a lot of musicians and conductors are very enthusiastic to see original manuscripts, to understand the history, to see the marks on the page?
I don't think I've ever left this area of excitement, because I've always tried wherever and whenever possible to study the manuscripts. Unfortunately, in case of Eroica, it is not possible because the manuscript is lost. The only copy which exists is not by Beethoven's hand. There is a printed facsimile of it, but unfortunately it is not the original manuscript. But to answer your question, yes, it was actually even before I started working with period groups that I felt even an emotional necessity to see the composer's manuscript, because sometimes it is the way the note is put on paper, its size, its shape, and
the intensity with which it was wrought.
Yeah, and in case of Beethoven, you can sometimes see through the paper.
Vladimir Yurovsky. He conducts the Philadelphia Orchestra in the last of 3 concerts featuring the Brahms Tragic Overture, Schumann's Piano Concerto with Benedetto Lupo as soloist, and Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, this evening at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall at 8.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Over the course of an almost 40-year-long career, syndicated columnist Molly Ivins rose to national prominence as a political commentator with a biting wit. Although she worked at the New York Times in the late 1970s and early 80s, most of her career was spent in Texas, where she wrote for the Texas Observer, the Dallas Times-Herald, and the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. When she died of cancer 3 years ago at age 62, Ivins left behind a devoted following, among them journalist sisters Margaret and Allison Engel. Now, as WRTI's Susan Lewis reports, the Engel sisters have written Red Hot Patriot, The Kick-Ass Wit of Molly Ivins, a one-woman show in which the stage and screen star Kathleen Turner brings the character of Molly Ivins back to life.
Now take a look at this picture. Tell me what's wrong.
That's right! It's all men!
Like the character she plays, Kathleen Turner is a powerful presence. She starred in dramatic and comedic roles in theater, movies, and TV.
I think that people think this character fits me so well because I am known to be rather outspoken and to have certain values, you know, that are in common with Molly, and because I'm just a big persona.
And she has a great laugh. If that weren't enough, Turner also bears a physical resemblance to Ivins, especially with her blonde hair dyed red for this show. Something of a casting coup, says co-playwright Allison Engel.
When Kathleen was sitting on the stage with her cowboy boots up on the desk and she smiled and she has dimples just like Molly does, it really was kind of remarkable feeling that this person was coming to life.
Finding the body of the person then creates my rhythms, you know, my whole energy. So right away I got the cowboy boots, you know. First thing, baby, get me those boots. Because, of course, that makes a huge difference. And I'm finding that she really is a real physical force. I mean, she was 6 feet tall, and I'm just finding myself towering over everyone. You know? I mean, that's what it feels like. Kind of a force of nature this woman is turning out to be.
The real Molly Ivins was born in California, raised in Texas in relative affluence. Her father was an oil and gas executive. Ivins was an undergrad at Smith College, spent a year in Paris, and earned a master's in journalism from Columbia University. But she returned to Texas, where she covered state government and later national politics, becoming famous for skewering the policies of George W. Bush. Margaret Engel says Ivins transcended her privileged upbringing.
She really stepped away from that and became one of the strongest populists ever. So it takes courage to step away from the way that you're raised.
Nor was she changed by success.
She was a contrarian and very much larger than life. That's unusual for women, particularly when you reach the heights. She was on 60 Minutes, she was on the New York Times, and she stepped away from that because she felt that she couldn't have the authentic voice she needed.
She was, says Allison Engel, a bold, gutsy, funny character in person.
When she went to the New York Times as a reporter, she was astounded that the New York Times did not allow dogs or bare feet in the newsroom.
She had a quirky spirit and a sense of joy about her work, where she used her humor to make quite serious points.
She says that jokes are very important to her, but that's not just because she enjoys them. It's because they're a means to an end, that she believes that if you make somebody laugh, they open up their ears and they hear you.
Ivins used humor, says Allison Engel, as a way of connecting politicians in Austin and Washington with everyday people.
She would say that she needed to put a little salt and chili on her words so that the truck drivers could understand them. And that may be a stereotype and a characterization, but that's what she was trying to do, is to write about important things in a way that everyone could relate to.
She was passionate about the American Constitution and the need for everyone to understand its significance.
She says in her final column, "Beloveds, no matter what you do with the rest of your life, in the rest of your life, you always have another job. You are a citizen."
She really was a patriot. For the last 15 years of her life, once a month, she would fly somewhere in the country at her own expense and give a speech to, let's say, an ACLU group or a group that was fighting for First Amendment rights.
Molly Ivins' public voice and private persona are celebrated in this play, which started with a selection of Ivins' writings and grew into a narrative story with the added words of Allison and Margaret Engel.
We do try to round her out as a true person because she was so remarkable. We really saw her somewhat as a Mark Twain or a Will Rogers. So there's the public persona, but we also really sketched in what her private life was like as well.
Enter Kathleen Turner, who got a look at the script from a fellow board member at People for the American Way and decided to sign on to play the role of the educated journalist and down-to-earth populist, the woman who somehow combined a fiery spirit with a sense of joy.
Lord knows I agree altogether with what this woman has to say. And I love the humor. I love personally to be funny. I like to make people laugh. You know, I just like doing that.
A one-woman show creates an intimacy with the audience. It can be lonely up there on the stage, says Turner with a smile.
It really is. You don't have anybody to play with, so you have to use the audience.
Does the audience kind of become another character?
Oh, absolutely. No, she's playing to them. You know, just forget the fourth wall. We just throw that away.
Leaving Kathleen Turner there to do, as Ivins loved to do, entertain and tell stories, like the one about John Henry Falk.
When Johnny was seven, he was already a captain in the Texas Rangers. And his little pal, Boots Cooper, was a sheriff. And, you know, I could just see him on their brooms, loping down the hill toward the hen house. Now, they'd been told to get rid of a chicken snake. I myself have never been face-to-face with a chicken snake, but I will take his word that it will scare the living shit out of you. So the boys enter the hen house, the snake rears up its head, and they tried to leave it at the same time, causing considerable damage both to the door and themselves. Now Johnny's mother calls out, "Boys, you know a chicken snake can't hurt you." Boots said, "Well, yes, ma'am, but there's something scare you so bad you hurt yourself."
It's a story with a moral, as timely now as it was then, about not letting fear make you harm yourself, whether by crashing through a door or throwing freedoms out the window. This was Molly Ivins' style, her way of opening ears.
She was brave. She was funny. She had a great spirit. She says, you know, celebrate the joy of a good fight. And I like that about her, you know.
As Americans work through the often contentious politics of 2010, this play reminds us of what Molly Ivins might tell us if she were here today. understand your freedoms and responsibilities, find your own voice, and summon the courage to use it with a smile.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Red Hot Patriot, the kick-ass wit of Molly Ivins, is now at the Philadelphia Theatre Company. Where is the future of classical music? Don't necessarily look to the Center City concert halls and the guest artist lists of the Philadelphia Orchestra. Look a little further from the thick of things, not toward the young and the trendy, but to the comfortable and the retired. Philadelphia retirement communities were among the first to hear Hilary Hahn play Bach. It's where performing arts organizations find their most stable and loyal donors, and it's the trial ground for internet simulcasts of Philadelphia Orchestra and Curtis Institute concerts. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns went to several such retirement homes in search of the cutting edge.
Somewhere in the Marlborough Music Festival's files lies a memo predicting crisis. The audience is graying. Where are the young people? How can classical music hope to survive? The date of the memo, 1958. Now, Marlborough rarely plays to an empty seat. Is it possible that those missing young people some 50 years ago are now the backbone of the classical music community? The man who discovered the Marlborough memo, the Philadelphia Chamber Music Society's Philip Manivel, speculates that classical music is embraced at a point in one's life when durability matters more than fashion, and most of all, when people have time to enjoy the finer things in life. That theory was borne out at a recent Sunday afternoon gathering of senior music lovers at the Hill at White Marsh. One was the retired surgeon, 83-year-old John Roberts, who always played trumpet, loved going to the orchestra when his beeper allowed, and now has a relationship with music, playing with amateur orchestras as well as attending performances, that wasn't previously possible.
It gives me more chance to learn the music beforehand, so I'm more involved in listening to it than I used to be.
Others, such as Phyllis Carter, now 80, found her way into the Philadelphia symphonic world only after coming here from less cultural terrains.
So it was very special to be able to go to the orchestra, and I did subscribe for 2 years.
Then there's the transplants from other high culture areas, such as Muriel Petkin from Boston, who is still adjusting.
And I miss James Levine and the Boston Symphony, but I'm sort of happy here.
She is one of the enlightened who knows the importance of contributing to annual fund drives of major cultural organizations. So it was, too, with the others in the room. These are the people getting out of the buses lined up around the Kimmel Center for a Philadelphia Chamber Music Society concert. Its full season of 65 low-cost events probably wouldn't be nearly as extensive without the over 70 crowd, many of whom are influential community and corporate leaders. The Friday afternoon Philadelphia Orchestra concerts, which can attract even more seniors, often fill the hall to the 90% range, even though the regular evening concerts drift as low as the 60s. Of the Friday afternoon audience, a third have subscribed for 15 years or more. The simultaneous applause here comes from both Horizon Hall and the Hill at White Marsh, where resident Nancy Hess jumped on a technological innovation from Spectacast. This is an internet-based company that simulcasts a full season of concerts at perhaps 20% of the cost of the Metropolitan Opera's movie theater simulcasts that involve more expensive satellite technology. White Marsh is one of 36 senior communities that subscribe to Spectacast's current first season. The equation is this. Most up-to-date auditoriums, such as the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall, already have robotic cameras. Most senior centers have lecture halls and recreation rooms with a large screen TV. Spectacast co-founder Mark Roop believes the market is just beginning to be tapped.
Our content contracts with the Philadelphia Orchestra Association, the Curtis Institute of Music, and with the Free Library of Philadelphia through and their author event series is content that is geared towards a demographic that it tends to be a little bit older. We know that there are 30,000 plus retirement communities in the United States. There are 50 million or so baby boomers about to hit retirement age, and believe that that's one of the growing markets.
For some classical artists, being simulcast into retirement communities will truly signify coming full circle. Most larger cities have organizations that do in-the-flesh outreach concerts at senior citizen communities. Philadelphia's Astro Artists is giving 86 during the current season, but not just for the benefit of people who want live music but can't get to the concert hall. It's a key part of young artists learning to communicate. In decades past, musicians learned repertoire inside out by playing a series of one-night stands in what was then known as the community concert circuit. Under the guidance of Astral, the Biava Quartet plays 15 retirement home concerts in 2 weeks and has continued to do so for the past 12 years, says violist Mary Pearson.
Sure, we all aim and love to play at Carnegie Hall and Philadelphia Chamber Music Society, you know, all the main places, but there's something that really brings you back almost to your roots and to the core of why you got into this. It's something that's been central to our mission from the start.
Part of the appeal, says cellist Gwendolyn Krosnick, is the physical closeness to the audience.
I mean, their energy was palpable today. Someone shouted out after one of the movements, like, oh my gosh, or wow, and that happens often in this setting. And that would never happen if you're playing Wigmore Hall or Carnegie Hall, because we know we're not supposed to have that kind of a reaction. But in a way, like, you know, why not?
Stapley in Germantown, the community where the Biava Quartet played Haydn and Grieg on a recent afternoon, is indeed a lively place where the running joke among its residents is, I'm here because I'm not all there. A more challenging day for the Biava Quartet would be playing for the deaf, who hold balloons in their hands in order to feel the music's vibrations. In such situations where communication has an extra imperative, quartet members say they're sometimes able to crack interpretive problems, those tough, dense Brahms string quartets, for example, in ways that they might not have arrived at other circumstances. This is something that they bring with them to more visible public concert venues. And that's the idea, says Astral founder Vera Wilson.
All of these experiences really have an effect on how they think, how they play their music, and how much of their emotions go into this.
It's easy for every succeeding generation to think, I'll be different at that age. I'm not giving up my punk rock or hip-hop records. You want to bet? Most retirement communities that I visited like to pipe in the music that was popular when their residents were young, like the soothing sounds of Bing Crosby and Ella Fitzgerald. But in future decades, there's no way that anything as raucous as the Sex Pistols or Public Enemy will be heard in any retirement community, if only because these are not places where people are encouraged to be agitated. So when many of us are 80, we'll probably be force-fed Barry Manilow and Celine Dion. Faced with that, wouldn't any sensible person take refuge in Beethoven?
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony and C under their music director, Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan. Our executive producer is Jack Moore. And I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.